Okay. So it's good to see everybody. Kind of look through the page here. Well, I can't see half of you. I'm glad all of you are on the page. I can see you. It's good. It's kind of weird, this Zoom thing. You've gotten so used to it, man. I don't know if I like it totally. No sound except for me talking. No faces except for the little squares that I got on one screen. It's kind of weird here, but I feel you, so that's all that matters, you know. You feel me, I feel you. That kind of thing. Right, so you think about that poem. We're gonna go a little bit deeper. Maybe I'll read it one more time. This might really send you the wrong direction. You're like, I don't, at first I thought I had it. Now I don't have it at all. So after our wedding, my husband and I put on robes together and soon went our separate ways. Not exactly what most would call a honeymoon. Is that what love looks like? Maybe. When you see what love is and what it isn't. Marriage is hard. The good times come and go. True love doesn't throw a curtain over the whole world and imprison whoever it cares about the most on an empty stage. When the mind is free, it's free of expecting more than is reasonable from any one person. Yeah, I still think that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So we're going to take another step into the sense doors, and I'm hoping that this step is more detailed, more into the actual practice of it, more larger, from a larger framework as to how come I think these sense doors are so important. I'm gonna turn a light on here. Yeah, maybe that one's better. So, mostly when we think about the sense doors, at least if you're anything like me, you don't even pay attention to them unless something unpleasant is happening. Unless something big, it doesn't have to be unpleasant. But I don't even know if I ever really noticed a sense door when something pleasurable was happening. I don't know. But unless something big, stimulating, dynamic happens, we don't really pay attention to them at all. But they are happening all day, every day. Billions of pieces of information is coming into all six of our senses constantly all day. And when something happens that we don't like, primarily this I don't like, we get stuck in some kind of overreaction. So if you think about it, we don't see or pay attention to the sense doors. We pay attention to our overreaction. And for most of you, if you're like me, you came to the Dhamma because of that overreaction. Like, I got to do something to settle this stuff down here. I need to find some kind of ease to suffering. And it doesn't have to be suffering that's like, you know, all hell's breaking loose suffering. You know, the end is near. It could just be I'm tired of the weariness. I'm just tired of not feeling a sense of aliveness in life. Somehow or another, we come to the Dhamma because the overwhelm that we're experiencing or the lack of liveness, that's what we see. That's what we're trying to deal with. And so when we first start practicing, you know, it's like everybody else, like it almost feels like the overwhelm gets increased. And the dumb itself is making the situation worse. But over time, things begin to settle down. Things begin to work it out. I stop hanging around those people that trigger me all the time. You know, I have more peacefulness in my house. Cleaned out some of all that clutter. Made the house look a little bit better. Rearranged things. Changed that job. Not working at that crazy job. Now I'm in a much more steady, still job that's more aligned with the way I am. I start living in a world, creating a world that's more in line with my values and who I am. But we start feeling that overwhelm getting kind of calmed down. But it's never really gone. You know, it's still in the background, messing with us. Still pops out every once in a while. Try to put a little damper on that, control that. But all through the, you know, we're doing good, going along, steady, easy. And then poof, something happens. And we're like trying to find ourselves back again. And over the years of this constantly having in the back of our minds, you know, I hear these Dhamma talks about liberation, but I don't really feel that. I still feel like I'm having to manage that back door so it doesn't really get out of control. That can lead to a kind of diminishing relationship with the practice. And we kind of do it, we don't kind of do it. Long-term practitioners have a really hard time with this because all of a sudden you kind of give up the luster that practice was really going to liberate you. You know, and secretly way back there's a thought like, I kind of knew this wasn't going to work. Not for me. My stuff is way too, it's a hot mess. It's way too bad. But in reality, that is a misunderstanding of the practice. It is a misunderstanding that we do so much that I think the Buddha's detailed discussion on the sense doors is a good way to begin to see where we're going down the wrong path. Why? What causes us to go down the wrong path? And inevitably, it comes from trying to change the outer conditions in order to affect our inner world. We think it's the outer conditions that are leading to all that overwhelm. And of course, the practice, we begin to feel freer and more relaxed and more ease when we're sitting. So we start changing all the outer conditions. And it does, changing our outer conditions, clearly is going to make things a little bit better. That's without a doubt. But you could have did that without the Dhamma. Nothing liberating about that. That's just a basic fact. So what is it that's so liberating about the Dhamma that the Buddha said, and I remind you from last year when we did the Four Noble Truths, he said he heard something that had not been heard before. So Buddha experienced something that had never been experienced before. You know, it's been billions of people, many sages, many Buddhas before the Buddha. Many great spiritual leaders and people of great wisdom. And the Buddha experienced something that had not been experienced before. That means what he experienced has to be something outside of dependent origination, outside of the bubble we live in. Outside of habit, outside of the standard way we do things. We got to do something different. And it's in that doing something different that liberation comes from. So this is not the detailed way in which he talks about the sense doors. Oh my God, he gets intricate in stuff. I mean, I can see how he said to his students one time that he had this handful of leaves, and most of us know this story. But he picked up a handful of leaves in the forest, and there are like thousands of trees and thousands of leaves on the ground. And he said, which is greater, the handful of leaves I have here or all the leaves in the forest? And I guess the monks were like, is this a trick question? Or I must go for the leaves in the forest is more. That's what I'm going for. I don't know. This is, you're walking with the Tathagata. It's like, I'm going to go with that door number one for $100. And I think a handful of leaves is what we're going to talk about tonight. Because that's right. He said, the Buddha said, there's way more knowledge in his mind than is necessary for liberation. So in each one of you, you have an immense amount of knowledge about all kinds of things. Some of you can be great professionals, and you have great knowledge about great things. But in order to get to this liberation, we need to narrow our focus down to the minute details of a very small cluster of things, which are the six sense doors. So it seems relatively insignificant when you think of it as just a handful of leaves compared to all the leaves in the forest. But it's not. Very significant. All the this gobs of knowledge we have is irrelevant compared to sense doors. So goodness gracious, I could get, I hate getting so caught in the Dhamma like this, because I could just go on and on and on. Okay, maybe it's because I come from a Black church. And when you go to, if you haven't been to a Black church, I got to tell you the way a Black church is. That pastor, when he gets to preaching, and if he really starts getting good, you might be there for about 4 hours. Don't even think about it. You got to wait until his energy or her energy gets settled back down again. It is so difficult for me to like, okay, tone it, narrow it down here. But I'm not going to spend 10 minutes talking about how it's hard to narrow it down. I'm just going to narrow it down. So the first thing, we talked a little bit about this last first couple of weeks, but we're going to go into more details on this internal, external understanding. And the first thing I want to talk about, okay, so Buddha gave 42 ways to practice with the sense doors. There are six sense doors, 42 ways to practice with it. That's a lot of narrowing down to details of a very small thing, but it has a great and powerful impact. So the first level of this understanding has to do with practicing with the sense doors, six of them, as external, internal experiences. So I want to share my screen for a second. I showed this to the Sunday sit, and I want to show it to you. I'm not going to be here long, not really going to go through this whole thing, but I want to help you begin to understand this is the internal understanding. We're just going to use how the eye works. So really, all that happens with the eye is light comes in. And that light is based on whatever objects is interfering with the light. And so those objects become, the density of it becomes known to us based on all these little intricacies of the lens and the iris and the cornea and all of this that happens in the brain, all of these different little layers here. I guess that's the retina. So there's this retina around there. Look at all those little veins in there. All right. So this thing I wanted to read to you says, with more than 200 million working parts in each one, the eyes are two of the busiest organs in the human body. It's very tiny, but it has 200 million working parts. And all of that gets interconnected. Go down one more sense door. Not doing them all, just the eye and the ear. So here we have some wavelengths coming into this ear canal. There's a middle ear. There's all these different little parts here. Half of these words I can't even pronounce, so I'm not even gonna try to pronounce them, but you can see lots of moving parts. All right. I'm gonna stop the share here because it's not really, I just wanted to show you these two things. I could have picked out a picture the same for skin, our ability to sense things and touch. I could have done the same for the nose and for the mouth and the tongue and the tasting capacity. I could have done the same thing for the brain, for the intellect, if where thoughts are generated. I could have. Even more so the body itself and all the different systems within our body, because digestion can cause some sensations, especially if it's not working right. So instead, I just picked those two. But I want us to think through the fact that we have six sense doors, and all of those sense doors have an immense amount of working pieces. And all of those working pieces have nothing to do with us. They all work on their own. Your ear knows how to turn wavelengths into sound or words without you doing anything. You aren't even part of it. And it's gonna decide what those wavelengths are, whether you believe it's that or not. This sense of understanding that internally there are all these working pieces that happen within our sense doors that make us up. I'm not going to go a lot on these because we covered this so much, but there's the external awareness. This is just the internal awareness. And you can be aware of these six sense doors that internally something's happening with your eyes, your ears, your nose, and the rest of them. You can be aware, not you can be aware, we ought to, as practitioners, train ourselves to be aware of the internal aspect of the sense doors, of the external aspects of the sense door, so that you are aware that this internal eye of its 200 million working parts is seeing form out of light. And somehow you think you're looking at a computer screen. You think you're looking at your couch or your chair or tuere, but you are looking at form. You are looking at shape based on the density of the light around me, around your screen, around the pixels of all the little thousands of little pieces of light brought in together. That's what we see. Sound. You think you're hearing Tuareg talk, but you're hearing wavelengths. So there's an external piece that we should, as practitioners, learn to distinguish, that there is an external modem in which our minds, our brains, have the capacity to allow us to experience aroma, or allow us to experience flavors, sights, you know, form and sounds, tactile, feel things, or become aware of ideas. All of these things we have the capacity to do. There are six consciousness. So it's not just that there is an eye with its 200 million parts and a form that the eye can see, but there's also the capacity for us to know that there is sight there. It's almost like, I don't know if a blind person knows that they see dark. I don't know. But I would think that that you could have no ability to see the light, but still know that seeing is occurring. I'm not sure. But the function itself, from the Buddhist perspective, is there is a separate function for consciousness. So awareness that you are seeing, awareness that you are hearing, awareness that you are tasting, and the rest of the sense doors. So now we have three parts, six each, for each of these sense doors. One more. There is contact. So it's not just that there is an object. There is awareness that you are seeing that object, with the internal capacity of the eye and the external capacity of your brain to allow shape or form to be known. All of that is coming together in this ability for us to see. So what the Buddha was pointing to is not just taking the seeing for granted, and when somehow or another your eyes can't see too well, or we begin to lose our hearing, we begin to lose our sight, we begin to lose some capacity, that all of a sudden we're in a kerfuffle about that loss of capacity. What the Buddha was saying was, practice with each one of those layers, four layers, six parts. Four layers for each one of the six sense doors. He was saying, practice with that. Get to know that. Get to know how intricate these sense doors are, because these sense doors is what is going to be the underlying foundation for all of our future suffering. All of our future suffering and existence in the world, what we think of as the world, is created through these sense doors and what comes subsequently after them. So knowing when you, and a way to begin to see how ingenious this is, when you're caught in obsessive thinking, you know how we get caught in some thought and it won't go away, especially if we did something we think we shouldn't have done, or we messed up, and it's constant. The mind is constantly whining and ruminating over something I did that I wish I hadn't done, but I did it, and why did I do it? And it's just constant. What I have found is one of the best escapes to that ruminating is to be kind with the mind, in this kind of, okay, I got your opinion on the subject. Let's see what the eyes are looking at right now. What do the ears think about this? Okay, let's get some other voices in here and begin to bring in these other sense doors. Because even if your mind is ruminating, you are still seeing, you are still hearing. And when I come from trauma, so I had such a aggressive mind for so long, I would carry around a vial of essential oil and I would start smelling it. And I would just smell and smell and smell till I could begin to let go of the aggressiveness of the mind, because the mind is not the only sense door happening. These other sense doors are equally valid, equally valuable. So that's what you're practicing with this the contact, the consciousness. But he said also, that's one layer. Those 6 times 4, those 24 are in and of itself. They're, that's one way to kind of work with this practice. But another way is to explore or investigate the nature of the intellect that comes in relation to these sense doors. So every single one of these sense doors, there's an intellectual thing that begins to happen. And now we're going to investigate an even deeper level here. I want to do this by, so it's not just the door itself. It's that capacity. You're really trying to get at what's really going on here, right? So what is it? If we see something we like, we think we see something lovely, something pretty, or we smell something foul, or we taste something sweet. We think that's what we're doing, but in reality, everything I just said is not true. There's no sweetness in my tea, in sugar. That is my own mind's intellect that determines the level of sweetness. If it were not so, my sister would not freak out at how sweet my tea is. I mean, I think my tea is just normal sweet. But if she tasted, she'll just be like, oh my God, that's too sweet. I don't get that. And I taste her coffee. She says that's sweet. Her coffee, whew, is so bitter. It's so terrible. Oh, terrible. Or I saw a little clip of one of my niece's sons when he was just about, I don't know, he probably was a little more than 12 months old. He was so cute. And she gave him a piece of lemon. And he went through all of these facial changes. It's just phenomenal how they just are like, wait, something has happened. But then he got this tooth, like he had two teeth. So two teeth grin and wanted some more. So it's sort of like, even though it was this terrible taste, there was a likeness to it at the same time. Kids are great for helping us see how experiencing things can be very different. So the way we are trying to experience this second level is not trying to just listen to the beauty of the sound or watch some beautiful sunset. That's not so much what we're looking for. In this level of practice, it's connected to sati. It's connected to mindfulness. It's connected to this deeper stillness that we want to see. How is it? What is the nature that I can see an object, a form, and experience joy? How does that happen? Where does that come from? That sense of joy, it's not in the object. So where does it come from? In our minds, how is it that something I hear can produce joy or produce distress, unpleasantness, or produce a sense of equanimity, meaning I don't even pay attention to it at all? That's what we want to know. For each sense door, there's an experience of one of those three, and we want to know 18 practices. What is it? How is it that this tea tastes so good? How is that? How can I like that tea? It's just on the tongue, and the tongue's got all kinds of little gadgets to it, little pieces and functionalities, and all the little taste buds have all the little nerves, and, you know, the saliva comes in and does its business. I don't know if I told you guys that I was in Vancouver, and we went to this guy that calls himself a chocolate connoisseur. And so what he did was he was trying to help us understand chocolate and the nature of chocolate. So he gives us a piece of, you know, the kind of chocolate you buy at the grocery store, the cheap kind of chocolate, gives us a piece of it. And we taste it. And he goes, well, what happens in the mouth? Explain it to me. I'm like, I'm chewy. So then he gives us a piece of his chocolate. And oh my God, it's not even a different, not no fancy chocolate. It was just milk chocolate, same as what you buy a candy bar. But I noticed that the mouth begins to salivate, that there's a kind of a, almost like a upbeatness that happens when you're eating this chocolate. And he said that it's because the mouth knows that that is food. It knows the difference between what is food and what is not food. So when the mouth is eating something, when we're eating something that's like cardboard, the mouth doesn't salivate. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't get excited. It's like, I don't know why she's eating cardboard, but okay, you're free to eat it if you want to, but we're not going to get involved. But when the mouth has a connection with food, it talks to the food, how much saliva needs to break it down, what do we need to do? It works with the flavor, the whole thing happens. I could not believe that. I don't even know how true that is. But I know when I was standing in that store, even after I had bit off the chocolate of real chocolate that he makes, and then went back to eat the other chocolate from the store, same thing, nothing, no saliva, no nothing. I was just chewing and swallowing, and that's it. So in some respects, what we're trying to do is to get down to that level, to be a sense door connoisseur. We want to begin to understand the nature of these sense doors. It would be like Ajahn Chah, he used to say, are you familiar with still water? And his students would say, yes. And are you familiar with flowing water? He's like, yes. Well, this is the still flowing water. This is stillness flowing. That's what this is. So this is beginning to understand the sense doors from a still place of just mindfully, with deep samadhi and awareness, getting interested in how is it that it's come to be that I think this is nice. It's pleasing. I like it. Okay, that's fine. We're not trying to get rid of the like it. But how is it that you like it? Where does it come from? In fact, can you begin to distinguish your, you know, the previous four links, can you see that those four links are preceding what you're actually experiencing? And it's the mental formations, the ignorance, the consciousness, the name and form that is adding to this sense that, oh yeah, this chocolate is, I mean, that this is, not that it's food, because the brain thinks the interaction between the chocolate I was eating and the body, this is real food. But if I put dark chocolate in my mouth, even if there's saliva and all that other stuff going on, it's bitter to me. I just don't know how people can eat that. And so even though I love milk chocolate and all of this is going on, it would still go on if it was bitter, but I wouldn't want to eat it. So there's some kind of distinction we need to make between the actual sense door and that which it is that we're sensing. So I want to give you an example of what, how this works. On Sunday morning, Arv rang, he was the meditation leader, and he rang this bell. Oh my God. The tone resonance of that bell just did a number on my ear, and I just fell in love with that bell. So for the first like 5, 6, 7 minutes of that sit, all I was doing was arguing with myself about how I can get that bell from Arv, or how can I get a bell like that? And I hate all my bells. My bells are terrible. And it was just this constant, nonstop drama about this bell and really wanting that bell. So I'm hoping you can hear that all of that was not about the bell, that there is no real sound in the bell. That experience I was having, there is a distinction between how I heard that bell and the wavelengths that come out of the bell. Because there were other people that said, nobody was going on and on about the bell. I somehow had some kind of resonance with it. But, you know, it could have just been like, that's just a bell story. That's what bells sound like. You know, it could have been in the striking that Arv did. It could have been the level of the kind of striker he had. I mean, it's all kinds of reasons why that sound happened the way it did. But in my ear, it became unbelievable. So this thing that I'm going to show you is what leads into the last part that we're going to talk about. Because Arv, I told everybody I was in love with that bell. So Arv said, oh yeah, it comes from East West Bookstore. So in my mind, I thought, I got to get on East West Bookstore and I got to get that bell, because that's the kind of bell I need to ring whenever I'm doing teaching. But something happened after the sit and I didn't get to it. And I remember all of a sudden realizing I wasn't even thinking about the bell. It was pretty much over and done with. I was fine with whatever bell I got. I didn't even think about it. I did another teaching and rang the bell and didn't even think about it. But then I think it was probably late. It must have been earlier this morning. I thought about that bell and I said, oh, I got to go to East West Bookstore. Check it out. Went to East West Bookstore. They don't have no bell. No bell. I'm all disappointed. And then I busted out and started laughing because I'm beginning. It's like we're actually all working with the sense door. So these sensory kinds of things are just going to come up for us. We're just going to notice it because we're talking about it. But what got me was how much I didn't care about it when the mind just forgot about it. And as soon as I looked it up on East West Bookstore, I'm back to the desire. Now I'm disappointed. This is what we're trying to see. It's not the bell. It's not whether I want the bell or don't want the bell. This sutta that I've been doing all this stuff from is about householders. So this is what the Buddha called, the last area he talked about were the 36 practices around what he called householder states of attachment. So we've already covered 24 aspects of the each of the sense doors. So 6 sense doors, 4 aspects each, 24 aspects of the door itself. We could practice, or the sense doors themselves, we could practice with 18 levels of understanding in this soft, subtle way. How is it that I'm interconnected like this with this object. It's just an object. It does not have any inherent value to it one way or the other. I am putting that value in it. Whether that value is I like it, I don't like it, or it's not even of importance, I'm not even paying attention. The third level, drop down one more level, is the states of attachment. And this is the level that I think is so precious. It's so special because it's going to go against what we think of in the normal way we practice. So these 36 levels of attachment, three types of attachment, which is, the standard, I'm attached to the things. It says acquisition of something from a sense door, remembering a previous acquisition. And when I think of that acquisition, what I think of is, I think of something as permanent. That bell sounds great. And I think that that bell is what I gotta have. That's it, because it's pleasing, it's nice. I gotta have that bell. And you know already, I could go to East West Bookstore just as soon as they open things up. I can get in that store and I could be looking for bells. And if I don't find that exact sound, I'll be disappointed with any sound I hear. It's that kind of permanency that we put in things. This bell has this sound, and we get locked into that. The acquisition of something from a sense door or remembering something that we acquired, that is based in joy. It's called a householder joy. It's like I'm going to see if I can touch on this in a minute, but it's based in this idea that it's joy. And the joy is inherent in the object. At the same time, if we don't get something or we lose something that we thought we didn't get it. We didn't get something special. Ergo, my disappointment when I looked on East West Bookstore, they don't have any kind of bells in there. That brings distress and sadness. And then the third one is simply not paying attention to the danger of not paying attention to these sense doors. We just don't get that, not paying attention to the fact that we're seeing, we are subjecting ourselves into this dependent origination cycle and setting ourselves up for future suffering. Along with those three attachments with each of the sense doors, there is a renunciation practice, which is basically seeing the changing nature of each one of these sense doors. When I first started practicing, I had this belief that somehow or another, the idea of renunciation is to let go of and stop wanting so much, right? Don't want that bell, Tori. That's somebody else's bell. Just let the bell sound and enjoy it while you have it and let it go. And that kind of understanding is rooted in a lot of the way we talk about practice, because we primarily talk about practice from the nature of monastics. And I think for a monastic, you might want to get to the underlying cause of that. Even why do you even want the bell? But that's not what Buddha's pointing to in this layer of practice. What he was pointing to, which is why I think he calls it householder practice, is there's nothing wrong with me wanting that bell. In fact, the wanting of the bell is why in the second level, you even want to consider, how is it that joy comes from this object? So the bell itself is not the problem. My wanting the bell is not the problem. And the renunciation that he's talking about is not renouncing wanting the bell. What you're renouncing is it's you're renouncing the idea that it is permanent. So your renunciation is really just about allowing yourself to see, oh yeah, this, I can see all of the things that pushes me to want the bell. Not, I need to renounce wanting that bell. I need to stop coveting or stop wanting other people's stuff. That's not the problem. The problem is that even in my wanting, I don't see the impermanent nature of what's happening. So whatever arises, we just want to see the impermanent nature of it. And then he ends with this kind of way, and we'll talk more about this next week, but he ends with this way of articulating that if we rely on this kind of a renunciation, not the kind of renunciation where we have to give up even wanting to have some goal or achievement. He's saying you don't give up, you don't renounce the goal because you can't get it. You are renouncing, or you are, the renunciation you're relying on is seeing that things come and go. So maybe this goal just either came and went, or it's impermanent in its nature. That you're leaning on that and not how do I give up the goal. I'm going to talk about this more because I knew I wasn't going to be able to get to all of this. But this is the area that I want to talk about next week. But I just wanted to touch on it so you could begin to see that this is where our, this is like the final stage. Giving yourself permission as a householder to have desires, to want things, to not like this, and I wish I had that, or ignore stuff. I mean, all of this is just the nature of being a householder. It's just the nature of practice. What you're giving yourself permission is to both allow for that, like not liking and ignoring, and the renunciation that comes with some kind of way of practicing with the impermanent nature of it either way. I think that's where I'm at. I think I want to leave it there. Yeah, I think I want to leave it there. So let me see if I can, let me see about a poem here. That we can end on. Okay. can't really find one. This is strange. No, maybe this one will work. This one I think will be okay. I haven't read this poem in a long time, so I like it. It's by Judy Sorum Brown. It's called Wooden Boats. And she writes, I have a brother who builds wooden boats, who knows precisely how a board can bend or turn, steamed just exactly, soft enough, so he, with the help of his friends, can shape it to the hull. The knowledge lies as much within his sure hands on the plane as in his head. It lies in love of wood and grain, a rough hand resting on the satin of the finished deck. Is there within each of us such artistry forgotten in the cruder task the world requires of us, the faster modern work that we have turned our lives to do? Could we return to a more craft? Could we return to more of craft within our lives and feel the way the grain of wood runs true by letting our hands linger on the product of our artistry? Could we recall what we have known but have forgotten? The gifts within ourselves, each other too, and thus transform a world as he and his friends do, shaping steaming oak boards upon the hull of wooden boats. So is there a way that the gifts within ourselves, which would be these sense doors, that we could transform the world as he and his friends do, shaping steaming oak boards upon the hull of wooden boats? So let's sit quietly for a moment. Great. Thank you so much for your patience, your time. I didn't go 4 hours. I might have gone a little longer than normal, but I did not go 4 hours. We can be thankful for that. So let's see if anyone has any comments they want to share or questions or anything like that.
Hi, Tori. Can you hear me? Hi. I have maybe two questions. One, something that's occurred to me is that, and I thought it was interesting that you chose to only show the eye and the ear. Like when I was thinking about this last week, I'm aware often of being aware of seeing or hearing, but like the other ones, I don't, to your point, like I don't really, like not the same level of awareness, smelling, tasting, and so forth. That was interesting. And then separately, the other question, when you're talking about the chocolate and then the physiological response, right, between like something that was a little bit better, where is it a different, is it still, can you say where the contact is? Is it when the chocolate? Yeah,
two different kinds of contact. So there's a contact link that I might be the one talking about it. June, July. No, I think Tim's going to talk about contact. There's the contact that actually happens. And I think what the Buddha in this contact is talking about is it's the same basic contact. But what I think he's pointing to is your eye is of no point unless there's a contact with a form, and that contact is happening whether we pay attention to it or not. So we're actually seeing, it's like practicing with, I'm going to give it to you. All right, here's, we're going to all do this little practice. So look around where you're at and notice anything that you can look at. So take a look at it. So I'm looking at my printer. I know that's a printer. I know it's my printer. I know where it's sitting at. I can see it. I'm looking at it. So there's a way in which we can look. Now soften your gaze so that you're aware that you are seeing, but it widens what you see to take up the full peripheral view. You see that distinction? So you can look at something and then soften the gaze and widen your view. All right, so then let's try it with hearing. Listen for some sound. It could even, if you don't have any sounds going on, you could listen to internal sound that you might have in your ears, or you might just hear nothing, just that silence. So just listen for the sound. I'm hearing, I'm listening to traffic, or I'm listening to someone talking, I'm listening. Even me, listening to Tuari talking. And now relax the ears. And let yourself just widen that experience to just hearing any sound that comes up. You're just hearing. You can listen to my voice or listen to a sound, and then you can widen, soften and widen the hearing so you can still hear whatever sounds is coming up, regardless of what it is. You can hear more than one sound at the same time. Okay, so if we come back and talk a little bit about this, what I think the distinction is on the external is that the external experience of hearing is that softer, just allowing sounds to come and go. You are aware that sound and hearing is happening, but you don't have any connection or care to what the sound is. There's no judgment on that. That is external experience of a sense door. So the same way with tasting, you're trying to see, what is the mouth doing when you put something there in the mouth? What's happening in this kind of softer, wider experience of eating versus eating a piece of chocolate? And I could not get to that wider open space when I was eating this cheaper store-bought chocolate because there was no conversation going on. It was like eating a piece of cardboard. So I never thought about that. I never realized that. So you can just see, if you're eating, what happens in the mouth when you eat something? What happens? How do you know when to swallow? I mean, all this sort of intricacy happens that doesn't have anything really to do with you. You could keep trying to chew as long as you can, but at some point the mouth is going to swallow whether you're ready for that swallowing or not. That's what you're paying attention to, is how unrelated to you it is. Versus you taking a bite of an apple, chewing, now I'm going to swallow. It's a very different experience when you just experience it as it is. And then I think that was the two questions, right? Okay, good, Brooke. So you see that was the two questions, right, David?
Yep.
Both the So that's what you're trying to look at. You're trying to, and I understand with the smelling, tasting, the sensing, those, and even the idea of watching your thoughts, all of these things, you may not normally be used to doing this, but that's the point of the practicing it, so that you can begin to see that desire for overeating or consuming the wrong kinds of foods or unhealthy food or whatever you want to think about it. Like, I don't want to eat certain foods, but I keep getting drawn to it. All of that is habitual, and that it's not actually in the food. So you're just trying to see what experience I'm having with this eating, or what is the experience I'm having of this smelling? Because there's a lot, smelling was very difficult for me. I could barely smell anything. But there's a lot of smelling to be done. But we've just trained ourselves not to smell. And unless something is strong, pungent kind of, or very sweet smell that we like, we won't pay attention to smell. So you just practice with it.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Good. So the Brooke sent a question here. So what we're trying to do on the first level in that, you know, the four different aspects of experiencing a sense door is, yes, to soften and just get to know what is, like it, we don't think about, we think thinking when we think contemplation, but you want to contemplate the intricacy of these sense doors. So how impersonal these sense doors actually are. They are as impersonal as your digestive system or your nervous system. It's like going to operate in fight or flight, whether you're up for that or not. And so these sense doors are all impersonal. They come with the body that we inhabit at whatever level they work. And so we're trying to learn how to sense in the internal aspect, how to sense into, contemplate and understand, oh, I don't have any control over that. And if I learn to see that, I can see the drawbacks of getting too caught up in what they are telling me, because I can get lost in something that I don't really have a lot of control over. So seeing the drawbacks, seeing the limitations that comes with experiencing something as a sense door, but not having any control over it. Likewise, in the external, you want to begin to see that you can actually let go of trying to control these different sense doors, and you can begin to experience them in this, again, you see, you don't have any control over what you hear, but you can see that the ear is going to pick up all kinds of sounds. And it can, you can begin to experience sound that you didn't even know existed. I remember one time Sharon Salzberg came out to Shoreline, and she did this this little exercise where she had people count how many sounds they heard over the course of a period of, you know, a couple of 2-3 minutes. And then, you know, I had 4 sounds, and people were saying, I heard 10 sounds and I heard 12 sounds. And I remember thinking, you didn't hear those sounds. You're just making up numbers. So then she'd do it again. And I would realize, oh, wait, I can hear 7 sounds. And the more quieter I got, the more sounds I heard. Very, very faint sounds that I wouldn't necessarily hear. But the ear is picking up all these sounds, whether we're aware of it or not. So you learn to sense how much the ear picks up, or the taste picks up, the flavors. And it's almost like relaxing into spaghetti and tasting all these flavors that the mind and the mouth can pick up and taste? Can we actually become quiet and still? That's why this is, there's a level of stillness we're dropping into, which that stillness helps us then contemplate, how is it that this tastes so good? Where is that coming from, that this tastes good, or that bell sounds beautiful? This bell is better than any other bell. Where's that coming from? That's what we want to do. Not in terms of something's wrong that I like it, but just that it is. We're human and this happens. What is that? That's how you begin to prepare yourself for that final layer, where you're going to renounce. The renunciation is just to allow whatever that beautiful experience is, that unpleasant experience, to just come and go, to begin to be able to see that. Then these sense doors are not going to be so much of a power towards desire. Desire still comes, like I still want that bell, and I'll probably be thinking about that bell for months now, but I don't actually have to buy it. Primarily because East West Bookstore doesn't have it on their website, but I'm not driving to East West Bookstore to go look for that bell. I'm just going to tell our no more using that bell on Sunday morning. But the point that I'm trying to make is, it takes the heaviness out of practice if we can learn to, as a householder, just to be with whatever's happening. Does this all make sense? This is the reason why this is so important is, this is the backbone of all the rest of these links. A lot of people think it's the feeling tones of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And I do believe that they have a huge impact that we're going to talk about. But beginning to understand how we experience the world through these sense doors, we can begin to see, of course desire comes. Of course, if I hear a bell that I really, really like, or I'm a Virgo, it doesn't have to be what I like. I am a Virgo. Virgos criticize everything constantly. If you know any Virgos, you know that we are like picky. And I can't help it. If I see something that's not straight, I am just, oh, don't let me go into an office where pictures are not straight. It's difficult to keep the mind not focused on that picture. But these are natural inclinations that I have, and yet I have to practice being with them in a kind of a humorous way without actually reacting to them as if they're a fact, which is the way I lived for many years. Anyway, we got like 5 more minutes. I got to let you go. Huh. So, Cubba, are you the announcement person?
I am.
Good. So Cubba is going to give us our announcements.
Right. Let's see. We have the dates for the 9 bodies training.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I am so excited about that.
It sounds very
Cool. Let me just say one thing about this 9 bodies training. So usually the 9 bodies is taught, when Philip Todd teaches it, he teaches it like it's a level of consciousness. And it is. We're going to talk about that part. But what I want to talk about with the 9 bodies is how these practices support a deepening of Vipassana and a capacity to experience that samadhi walking around the house. So that we don't have to be on retreat in order to begin to experience these deeper states of consciousness for practitioners. And so that's what I want to focus on for the weekend. So I hope I see you.
Which, Mary, I must have the date wrong, and I thought I confirmed it on the website. It's not May 12th.
June 12th. It's June 12th, that Friday. That's a Friday night Dharma talk. Just going to be a Dharma talk, some questions and answers, 7 to 9. And then Saturday and Sunday, I kind of changed the date time a little bit. I don't know what I was thinking. I was probably thinking about Philip's retreat date times. So it's not going to be at 8 o'clock. It's going to be at our regular 9 o'clock in the morning and go to 4:30.
Thank you. And the introduction to meditation class, Tim mentioned to announce it. When I looked at the website, I'm going to rely on you here, Tweri. It looked like it was nearly over.
No. That's the current one.
Okay, I didn't see
it. He's talking about the summer one.
Okay. I didn't see it.
Let me see if I can find it. So you go ahead with the other announcements and I'll...
Okay. So the only other thing I have, two other things. One is reflecting on the climate crisis in July 11th from 10 to 2. Wonderful opportunity to join with other Sangha members and reflect on the current crisis. Please come and join us online. And I'll just mention looking at this. Yes.
We did not hear all of that.
Was I freezing?
Yeah.
Okay. Reflecting on the climate crisis, July 11th, from 10 to 2, and then, of course, will be Zoomed. And please remember that as an antidote to contraction, Dana is a wonderful practice, the practice of generosity. It's an opportunity to practice generosity through Dana and support our teachers and our teachers.
Okay. You got all that, you guys? Did you get it? It's really about Dana. And I know Dana's kind of hard. I can see where it could be... I can see where it can be difficult, but it is important. It's not just important to Sims that you help support us even in this difficult time. So no one's expecting you to give more than you can. There's no expectation of any amount that you give. And there's no expectation, it's just that you're supporting the teachers. What makes Dana so important, especially in a time like this, is that you don't lose your generosity in a time when you're thinking that the natural inclination would be there's not enough. And it's against that to go outside of that natural mental mind thought, no, it's not enough. You got to go outside that and say, yes, it is. It's enough for me to give. There's always enough for me to give. So that's what it's pointing to. Tim's beginning a meditation class starts in July on Thursday, July 9th. So what he wanted to do is for people to begin to think about if you know someone that might want to take a beginning class. This class is ending, but in the summer, we will start on July 9th. With 6 weeks of intro with Tim. All right, so just beginning to think about the summer class. All right. I think that's it. We got a minute, Cubba. We did good. So I really appreciate your attentiveness around this subject. I hope I made it interesting enough that you're like, okay, this is something I want to check out. Because it's this kind of intricacy that the Buddha did with basic little practices that make for wisdom. It's not learning some new way of being or how to clear out your cupboards. It really is taking these relatively simple little things that we take for granted and looking at them with more depth and more attentiveness. All right, so I will see you next week and we'll do a final kind of a summary of this would mean adding it a little bit more, since you're actually coming the second time. I think we should add a little bit more to it. And I'll see you then. We'll talk about some little bit more into practice. Is there a class? It's a holiday? Oh, yeah. There'll still be a class. I think it's Memorial Day. Yeah, we'll still be here, even though it's Memorial Day. All righty. Besides, Memorial Day will be over with by 7 o'clock at night. We're moving into Monday, getting ready to go to work. All right. See you. Thank you. Bye-bye. Yeah.